Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview via phone with the eminent and celebrated computer scientist, Dr. Maria Clavé. Maria is currently Dean of Engineering and a Professor of Computer Science at Princeton University.
Maria, you have a long history of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions to the field of computer science, mathematics, and to the computing industry, education, and global community. We are particularly fortunate you found time for this interview. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
I'm really glad to be part of this interview series. I feel honored to be participating, and just a pleasure to do it.
Maria, these series of questions revolve around your current work and past research interests and the conclusions you derive from this work. What are the vision, mission, objectives, and values behind your current roles at Princeton? And what do you hope to accomplish, and how will you bring this about?
I was recruited to Princeton University by President Shirley Tilghman, and she had a vision for what engineering should be doing in the 21st century. And just to sort of encapsulate it very briefly, it's that technology is having such a huge impact on society, not just the developed world, but also the developing countries. And she felt that if we were going to be serious at Princeton about educating leaders that were going to play roles in government and industry, in academia and so on, that engineering had to be taught and also had to do research in a way that engaged the entire university. And so whether we're teaching engineering courses at the undergraduate or graduate level, we should be making these courses accessible to non-engineering students as well as engineering students. But moreover, both our teaching and our research should be highly interdisciplinary and should focus on solving the major problems that face the world. So her idea was to take a really excellent engineering school, the really excellent engineering school that already exists at Princeton, and to push it forward to just a new level of excellence and to try and model the kinds of activities that the very best engineering school should be doing for the future. So what we're trying to do at this point is we're recruiting new faculty, we're establishing large new research projects and a new Center for Innovation Engineering Education. And the whole idea is that everything we do, we want to instill with an interdisciplinary perspective. We want to make sure that we're bringing in people who understand policies, cultural contexts, and so on, as well as, of course, the very deep technical scientific underpinnings of things. And we're doing this in a way that we're trying to reach not just the engineering students at Princeton, but also all of the students. And so one of the things that's really remarkable about Princeton is that already more than two-thirds of the non-engineering students take courses from the engineering school. And they're not gut courses, and they're also not just, you know, your standard computer literacy course. They're courses that cover a wide range of technologies and societal issues, and it's something I think makes us really unique.
Well, you're definitely training the leaders of tomorrow.
That's the goal.
Well, that's great. Where do you see your work heading in 5 years?
Well, hopefully within 5 years we'll made a really significant impact, not just at Princeton, but on the whole culture of science and engineering around the world. One of the things we're trying to do, of course, we're not alone in doing this, but we're trying to link up with industry and government and with other universities, because I think it's very important. We really need to make a significant cultural change in engineering and science. And, you know, I hope that 5 years from now, one will be able to look at engineering and science, and one will see a lot more interdisciplinary education and research. One will see a much greater focus on addressing the major issues that face the world, and one will see a lot of a much more diverse population that is contributing to engineering and science. And that, of course, means more women, more underrepresented minorities, but also more artists, more poets, more dancers. You know, just I think that technology is so important to the world today that we need to make sure that everybody is invited to come and contribute to the decisions that we're going to make in the near future.
Well, that's really interesting. The breadth sounds fascinating, and it looks like it's a very positive direction for the university. What's your current area of research interest, and what do you foresee as the impact of this work?
My current area of research is in the context of a fairly large interdisciplinary project called the Aphasia Project, which is a joint project between the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and Princeton. The idea of the Aphasia Project is to explore the use of technology, particularly computing technology, to assist people who've lost language skills, usually through a stroke or brain trauma, and improve their quality of life and their ability to function independently. So the Aphasia Project, what we're doing right now is we work with psychologists, speech language pathologists, and computer scientists. We work with people who have aphasia, and we're testing out various kinds of handheld applications. For example, a daily planner that includes images and sound as well as text. Our idea is that given the advances in computing technology, you really can now make multimodal applications that use images and sound as frequently as they use text. And this should provide not just people with difficulties with language, but also the more elderly population or people with various kinds of cognitive deficits more support in terms of being able to function independently.
I see that your work continues in your sort of ability to reach out and to make a difference. So from your long career of sustained successes, which three events or achievements stand foremost in your mind, and for what reasons?
Well, the first one I think I have to mention is being part of a team that really grew and built the computer science department at UBC in the late 1980s through the 1990s into one of the best computer science departments in the world. And that was, I think, being head of the department for 6.5 years and during a time when we doubled in size in virtually every respect and tripled in some other ways, but also creating a community where there was just this, we had the sense that we knew we didn't have a lot of resources financially in terms of the other universities we're competing with, particularly in the U.S. So we decided that we were going to make it the best possible place to work and live, and that we would recruit people by the opportunity to come and make a big difference. And I have to say that I love that department. It's an amazing department. The people in it, the spirit, and so on are just incredible. It was certainly one of the most fun, exhilarating, challenging, and ultimately rewarding things I've ever been involved in my life. So that would be number one. One of the things that I, of course, now that I'm at Princeton and no longer at UBC, I really miss the department, but I know that it's going to continue to become even more successful, and you know, it has that life of its own. The second one, I would say that I feel really very good about is being part of a community that has focused issues on the whole issue of gender in computing. So the fact that many fewer women choose to major in computer science, the fact that fewer girls play computer games, that there's a difference between boys and girls about how they perceive themselves in terms of their ability to learn programming and things like that. And I would say, so I was one of a group of people, well, actually founding co-chair of something called CRAW, which is the Committee on the Status of Women in Computing of the Computing Research Association. I was one of the co-founders of that group in 1990. I also worked for, held the IBM NSERC chair at UBC for 5 years from 1997 to 2002 when we also worked on this issue. And I think that certainly the problems are not resolved by any means. In fact, there continues to be decreasing interest among women in undergraduate computer science programs. But I think that over the past 15 years, we've actually learned a tremendous amount about what the underlying issues are and what would need to be done in order to address them. And so I feel really, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that even though we haven't solved the problem, I think we now know a tremendous amount about what can be done to solve the problem. And I actually have overwhelming confidence that we will solve the problem, probably not within the next year, but I would say within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to make significant steps forward. The final thing I'd like to mention is one of the things that, I mean, this sounds sort of ridiculous in this context, but one of the things that I'm most proud of is that I've been really lucky to be married to an amazing person and have two amazing children who are now 23 and 20, and to have just this, a family life that I feel is probably the most important thing in my life to me, and my children are probably the two things I'm proudest of being part of in my entire life. So, you know, I often people think that you can't, you know, be really committed to your career and be a parent or particularly be a mother. And I happen to know lots of women who are amazing scientists or engineers and also amazing mothers. And so for me, I think just having those two children, having my husband, who we celebrated our 25th year anniversary this year, having that at the same time as having been very committed to a career, that to me seems like probably the most important achievement.
Wow, that's very compelling. You spoke on this topic at the ACSM 2005 symposium. Based upon your research, what are the key points in increasing the number of women majoring in computer science and engineering? How did you come to these findings?
The two things we need to do in terms of having more women in computer science, first of all, we have to increase their interest. And the second one is that we have to make sure that we increase their sense of belonging once they actually choose to take some courses in computer science. The way that we found this out is that we did a large study in Vancouver starting in the late 1990s, in which we surveyed female and male students in grades 8 through 12, both within the city of Vancouver, but also in several other more rural regions around the province. And what we found was that there's a very significant difference in interest in taking computer science courses between female students and male students, and it's already there by grade 8, and it doesn't change over the 4 or 5 years of high school. The ways of increasing interest, what seems to be very clear is that many female students are much more interested in using computing technology as a tool to do something else. And so I think it's very important for people to realize that whether you want to work in medicine or in law or in environmental issues, any of those kinds of things, computing technology is probably the biggest tool that's going to make a difference. And so we have to change the image of computer science as being something you just do to program a computer, you know, 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, to people really understanding that it is the dominant technology that you can use to solve the major problems that face the world. In terms of increasing a sense of belonging, we need to change the culture within computing to welcome people who have broad interests. I think one of the unfortunate things that's happened is that there's this perception that the only people who want to, you know, major in computer science are people who just want to program all day. And in reality, the people who are computer scientists have interests in, you know, just the same diverse set of interests as anybody else, from sports to travel to music to fine arts, politics, etc. And I think we need to make it clear to the students that they can be in computer science and still be crazy about learning Farsi or, you know, traveling to South America or whatever, and it's not, you know, that those things, that students who love to do lots of different things are going to feel very comfortable in a computer science major.
As founder and director of Electronic Games for Education in Math and Science, what were your most significant findings, and how have these findings been implemented?
I think the most important finding, first of all, is that you really can use games to increase interest and motivation in areas like mathematics and science. I think many people have made this hypothesis, and over the 10 years that we ran the project, it was very clear that games could be very effective. The second thing is that games have to be very carefully designed for that to actually work, and you have to also use them carefully. You can't just design a game and then tell students to play it. You actually have to design the game with a lot of care, but then also have the teachers use the game in integrate it closely with the other things that they would be doing in the classroom, because it's very easy for students to learn something while playing a game but not see how it relates to the material they would be learning in the class. And if they can't actually transfer that learning, it's not really doing them any good in the learning context. And then the final finding is that, contrary to many beliefs, or the beliefs of many at the time, girls actually do like playing computer games and video games, but they like different kinds of things, and they like to play in different kinds of ways. And so if you want to use games in an educational context, it's important to both design them in a way that's going to be attractive to both girls and boys, but also to encourage students to use them in ways that are attractive to both girls and boys. Now, we published many papers on this and also made our findings available on a website. And one of the things that has been very interesting to me is the number of times I've run into somebody who had never actually written to us or been in contact, but who said, oh, yes, of course we've read your papers. We used that when we designed such and such. And so I think that what we did in that eGEMS project has actually been taken into account by many designers, both of educational software but also of game software. And it's interesting, as we see games evolve, we are starting to see more games that incorporate many of the things we said were going to be important in terms of attracting girls and young women.
Wow, that's quite fascinating. Very interesting work. Maria, you shared the stage with Bill Gates as the moderator for the annual Microsoft Research Faculty Summit, drawing nearly 400 computer science professors from 175 schools in 20 countries. The following series of questions are based on the summit. There are more jobs, higher salaries in computer science, and the world is driven by technology, and yet, according to Gates, there is a student enrollment paradox. You have noted that according to statistics from the UCLA's Higher Education Research Institute, interest in computing science dropped by more than 60% from 2000 to 2004. These same trends also apply to Canada. Why is there a decline in computer science enrollment?
I think the decline is caused primarily by two factors. The first one is that there was this tremendous hype in the late 1990s about dot-com companies and the opportunities to get rich very quickly, very rich very quickly. And when the bubble rightly burst in 2000-2001, unfortunately the general public really felt that that was the end of computing technology, of the jobs in computer science, and that, you know, basically computing technology, information technology had come and gone, and that it was basically just a has-been kind of area. So that's the first thing. The second thing is all of the publicity and about outsourcing of software development jobs to India and China. Now, it certainly is true that there as a result of the telecom bust and you know, after the Y2K problem was solved and so on, there has been downsizing in a number of information in the number of information technology jobs in 2000, 2001, and going into 2002. And so there is some reality that, you know, that supports the public belief. What has actually happened, however, is that the number of jobs has picked up again, and we're back past the number of the peak in 2000 and in 1999. But the public perception has not caught up. And so, you know, I meet many students who tell me that their parents and their teachers and guidance counselors are telling them not to study computer science because there won't be any jobs. The reality is that computer science graduates still earn more and have more job offers when they graduate than students graduating in other areas of engineering. So the reality is that the jobs are there, but unfortunately the public perception is that there aren't jobs and there won't be jobs.
What are the implications of this decline in the short, medium, and long term? How will it impact our competitiveness, growth, and the technology labor market?
I'm very concerned about this decline for many reasons. The first one is that it is true that there's a large demand for these kinds of skills and competencies. And so if in North America, and this is also happening in Europe and so on, if we stop educating people in these areas, it will certainly increase the flow of jobs to places like India and China, because they are still increasing the number of graduates in information technology related areas, computer science, electrical engineering, and so on. The second thing is that every other area of business and society also needs these skills, because the impact of information technology, whether it's in healthcare or in monitoring the environment or in education, is still increasing. And so if we are producing fewer students who have skills in this area, it's going to not just impact our ability to compete in technology areas or in information technology industry, it's going to impact all areas of industry. So I think that one of the most important things that has to happen in both Canada and the U.S. is to reverse this decline.
What can be done to stem this decline in student interest?
I think we need to do several things. The first one is that we need publicity campaigns by industry, by professional societies, by everybody, to make it clear the kinds of job opportunities that are there and how important the role of computing technology is in all other areas of society. So that's the first thing, is we simply need to get much more publicity for that. The second thing is that within universities, and this idea comes from Rick Rashid, who's the Senior Vice President for Research at Microsoft, we need to make sure that the first computer science course that students take is the best course they've ever had in their life. Because, you know, often we turn students off by an unsuccessful first course, and then they're certainly not going to be interested in majoring in the area. The third thing is that we need to offer more programs that I call Computer Science Plus X. So these are essentially double majors programs that allows a student to get a degree in computer science as well as a combined degree in biology or art or psychology or languages or whatever, because we know that those attract more students, and particularly more women and other groups that are less likely to study computer science. And then my final suggestion, which nobody's implemented yet, but I suspect will start to happen, is one of the biggest areas where we need more people who understand information technology and its potential is in healthcare. Especially, there are very few doctors who understand computer science, information technology at all. And so my idea is that we ought to start digital pre-med programs where essentially it's a computer science major that's designed as a pre-med program, and work with med schools to promote students getting this kind of pre-med degree before they go to med school, so that we'll actually educate a generation of physicians who understand about the use of computing technology and what it can do within healthcare. We know that pre-med programs are some of the most popular for bright students as undergraduates, and I think if you had a computer science major that was a pre-med program, you would get a lot of students.
Those are some really interesting ideas. I hope they get implemented worldwide. Can you comment on the decline in funding for computer science? What are the implications here, and how can this be reversed?
There are two main factors in the United States that are influencing the decline in funding for computer science research. The first one is that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, for the last 20 years has provided a large amount of the funding for basic computer science research. And over the last really 3 or 4 years, they have dropped that funding very significantly. And so there has been a tremendous, this has had a huge impact in the United States, less so in Canada, because DARPA funding doesn't usually flow across the border, but certainly within the U.S. it has had a huge impact. That has meant that it's put increased pressure on the resources from the other major funding source in the U.S., which is the National Science Foundation, and there's just been a tremendous amount of stress in terms of the ability of people to get funding to support particularly graduate student education. So this has been a very significant problem in the U.S. I think it's less of a problem in Canada for two reasons. One is DARPA is not an issue in Canada. The other is that more Canadian graduate students actually get their own funding through NSERC rather than having to be funded off a professor's research grants. And so it's probably true that Canadian computer scientists in some ways are benefiting because they're probably getting even better graduate student applicants coming, choosing to study in Canada instead of the U.S. because of the situation in the U.S. The other thing that has been happening over the last 5 years is the decline of industry, of basic computer science research being conducted in industry research labs. And again, this is less of an issue in Canada because there were fewer large industry research labs in Canada, but in particular, we have seen the demise of the digital research labs, all of the telecom research labs in the U.S., and companies like IBM even are doing less basic computer science research than they were doing 5 years ago. And so what this means is that overall, there is simply less computer science research being funded, and what that means in the long run is that we're going to be less competitive, particularly with in comparison to what's happening in China, where they are really increasing their investment in research in computer science.
What role can the major computing associations, such as the Canadian Information Processing Society, or CIPS, play here in addressing these challenges and concerns?
I think the most important thing that the professional societies can do is to work on the image issue and just really promote the reality that both the people working in these areas and the technology that gets done created through research is of tremendous importance, not just to the information technology industry, but to all parts of society and all the other industry sectors as well.
Maria, these are the concluding set of questions about the future and any free comments you may wish to make. Please make predictions for the future, their implications, and how business executives and IT professionals can best prepare.
I think probably the biggest thing that is changing right now and is going to have an impact on the future is what is happening in China and India. It's very clear that, particularly supported by advances in telecommunications, connectivity, and so on, all industries are going to become increasingly global in the sense that it will be more and more likely that whatever task is being undertaken, it will be undertaken by a team of people that are based in different parts of the world. And so every information technology professional absolutely needs to become comfortable with working with in teams of people from all around the world and understanding what the cultural issues are, what the opportunities are, and so on. So that's the first one. The second one is, and you know, people have been saying this for at least 25 years, so it's not new, but you can't say it too often because it just becomes more and more true. The most important things in terms of having a successful career are not just your technical skills, but your ability to learn and enthusiasm and interest in learning new areas of technology, because technology just continues to change all the time. And also your ability to work with other people, and not just people with a strong technical background or a technical background in your own area. The big advances are going to happen through the deployment of algorithms, software, technology, and so on in other areas, such as healthcare or the environment or energy and so on. And the people who are going to do well are the people who are capable in working in multidisciplinary teams to do that. And so, you know, it really comes back to energy, creativity, communication skills, people skills, as well as, of course, a very strong technical basis and the ability to continue to learn throughout your career.
What does your research indicate about the burgeoning China-based market?
I think that China is going to be a key driver over the next decade, but probably longer. They are moving and changing so fast. It's such a large population. It's a relatively well-educated population, and they have determination and energy that is unmatched around the world. So, you know, I just think there's going to be enormous advances that happen in China, and I think we want to be part of those, part of the team that participates in those advances rather than, you know, a community that's on the sidelines.
How about India?
India is a different, it's very interesting. Obviously the cultures are extremely different. And for example, one thing that is very different in India, just looking at the computing research issues, China is investing very significantly in terms of graduate education and you know, research PhDs in computer science. And I think they see that they need to do that in terms of driving the creation of the technology themselves. The number of people receiving PhDs in computer science in India is much, much lower. It's, you know, it's perhaps 35 a year or something like that, which is just absolutely tiny. However, India has just very recently, I'd say within the last two or three perhaps years, become interested in increasing the research capacity within the country. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens as India tries to go from, you know, basically a sort of a code shop environment where it's just, you know, programmers for hire to actually developing and advancing new technologies themselves. So I think those, India and China, are probably the two most interesting places in the world right now. And again, I would repeat, I think we want to participate in this. We want to be part of this. We definitely, you know, we want to participate this as a team effort, not as a competitive effort.
Maria, that's really interesting, your research with regards to China and India. Perhaps you can comment on the students at Princeton from those areas, that is, from China and India.
Until recently, the largest, the country that provided the largest number of foreign graduate students at Princeton was China, and in fact that is still true, but the numbers have been decreasing. India is certainly another country that provides a lot of graduate students, but it's a much, much smaller number than the number coming from China. The reason the numbers have decreased in the United States are due to the new, after 9/11 in 2001, there were much greater restrictions put on visas for foreign students. That's been eased up a little bit, but it's still true that foreign graduates, the number of applications from foreign graduate students, particularly from China, have decreased over the last 3 years. I think this is probably a benefit to Canada. Certainly, from what we've heard, there are a lot more students who would be interested in studying in Canada, more interested in studying in Canada than the U.S., partly because it's just, and I have to say this, I mean, I'm a Canadian working in the U.S., and it is a pain being a non-U.S. citizen in the U.S. these days.
Maria, you are continually selected as one of the top researchers and senior academics. How do you wish to continue to shape the world and contribute to the fabric of history?
Of all the things I would like to do in the rest of my life, I think the most important one is to continue to work on the culture of science and engineering so that we become more inclusive, more welcoming to traditionally underrepresented groups, more supportive, and so that we focus more of our attention on really trying to solve the major problems facing the world. I don't think the future of the world is at all secure. There are just, whether it's global warming, the possibility of pandemics in terms of disease sweeping the world, energy sources, just all of these kinds of things, the path that we're on right now is not sustainable. There are going to be big changes, and I think that scientists and engineers are going to be, they're not going to be the only people who play an important role, but they're certainly going to be one of the important groups contributing to decisions. And I would just like to try and help make sure that we make positive contributions rather than negative contributions as the decisions go forward.
Do you mind if I ask maybe a couple of fun questions that are sort of
up there? Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Maria, what's your favorite fun time activity?
Oh, I have lots of favorite fun time activities. So one of them is running, another one is painting, another one is kayaking. A new addiction are the Sudoku puzzles, and I love reading as well.
Maria, what's your favorite technology or fun thing, gadget?
I got to say I love my tablet PC. And one of the reasons I love the tablet PC is that I really, truly love being able to scribble on things as well as type things in. And so I'm a big fan of the new tablet technology.
Okay, Maria, outside of work, what is your passion?
Oh, I probably my number one passion is painting. So I've been painting since I'm sure I was 5 years old, and I am absolutely obsessed with it. I paint every week. Right now I'm working on a series of images of flocks of birds. They range across the entire gamut from being quite abstract to being quite literal. And these are large watercolor images. They're full sheet watercolor, which is 22 inches by 30. And I'm just absolutely obsessed with this. So I'm doing a show in the cafe of the Equad with these images March 13th. And so my really big thing is I have to get them ready and have them framed in time. But, you can find me painting all over the place. I paint in meetings. I often paint while I'm on conference calls. And, of course, I paint at home and while I'm on vacation and so on.
That's interesting, painting on conference calls.
I'm not painting on this one, I've got to say.
Maria, with your demanding schedule, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview. Thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
It's been a pleasure, a great pleasure speaking with you, Stephen.